Questioning Paul, Chapter 4, Part 3.
Paul is displaying signs of the psychosis of schizophrenia, as well. There is a complete breakdown of rational thought processes in his writings. His arguments, even the best of them, are borderline insane. His emotional outbursts are atypical and inappropriate. His speech and thinking are disorganized. His antagonism toward Yahusha's disciples screams paranoia, its most telling symptom. Paul is even projecting bipolar tendencies, a mood disorder characterized by manic or prolonged periods of irritability. This manic expression of bipolar psychosis is evidenced by his extravagant claims, by his egotistical self-esteem, and by what's known as the pressure of speech. Here, the psychosis is present in his frenzied style, an approach that is cluttered and often unintelligible, tangential and unrelenting, all motivated by an urgency which is not apparent to the audience. Therefore, when we compare what we are reading in Paul's letters to the most common and telling symptoms of psychoses, we discover a near-perfect match. It has become evident that the founder of the Christian religion was mentally ill. And if not psychotic, then surely nauseating. This is making my stomach turn.
Because you put up with someone who and something which makes you subservient, completely and loving you. Someone who and something which is exploitive, someone who and something which is controlling, someone who and something which is exalted, even someone who or something which fills the skin of your person. 2 Corinthians 11 verse 20.
Before I share why I'm especially troubled by this, let's first consider the rendering proposed by the Nassau-Lalanz MCREYNOLDS interlinear.
Endure, for if some you enslaves thoroughly, if some eats up, if some receives, if some lifts up on, if some interface you beats.
The reason for the wide variation is that I, as a standalone concept, conveys if, but when used in conjunction with an indefinite pronoun, eitis becomes whoever, whatever, anyone who, or whosoever. Also, while the verbs katidalu, make subservient, katsoi, is exploitive and destructive, and duro, flays the skin, are decidedly detrimental, anakomai, put up with, lambano, grasp hold of and control, and aperimai, is exalted, can be good or bad depending upon the subject and context. Also, while prosopon means face, in Greek, it also conveys person, frontal appearance, outward presence, and a particular place in front of an individual demonstrative of a relationship. It is a compound of prose, before and with regard to, and oct, a visage or feature which allows one to be seen in a particular way. Moving from grammar and etymology to content, Paul's statement is very troubling for multiple reasons. It starts off suggesting that the Corinthians willingly accepted someone who and something which enslaved them, making them subservient. To this ill treatment the Corinthians allegedly endured, Paul added exploitation and control mechanisms. So what's bothersome about this is when we return to Galatians, we will discover that Paul contends that Yahweh and his Torah are responsible for this abusive influence. He refers to them as pedagogos, a pedagogue who instructs in a particularly pedantic and dogmatic manner using strict, old-fashioned methods, with an overbearing demeanor as slave trainer, being a harsh, arcane, and enslaving taskmaster, in Galatians 3 verse 4. Furthermore, in the context of history and Paul's letters, apart from Yahweh and his Torah, there are no other candidates. None. At this time the Greeks living in Corinth weren't being enslaved, they weren't being exploited or controlled, much less flayed, by anyone. They had become beloved and highly esteemed members of Roman society. But if you think that there was a political, religious, economic, or military presence in Corinth between 50 to 55 CE that was actually enslaving Greeks, forcing them to be subservient, that was exploiting and controlling them while savaging their bodies, then please share this history with me. Recognizing how horrendous this statement and the one which follows becomes when we realize that Paul is calling Yahweh and his Torah enslaving, exploitive, destructive, controlling, and mutilating, I conducted an investigation to see if something else may have been afoot in Corinth at this time. But there was no Roman legion garrisoned there. In fact, Corinth enjoyed a return to prominence during the 1st century CE, paying homage to Poseidon. The Isthmian Games were recommenced, second in their fan appeal only to the Olympics. The Isthmus put Corinth in control of two major harbors, both of which were booming, as well as in command of the most popular trade route between Asia and Rome. While much of Corinth had been torched by Rome in 146 BC for being a member of the Achaean League, the Romans left the old marketplace and Apollo's temple intact. And then showing that bygones could be bygones, between 46 and 44 BC, Julius Caesar used Roman capital to rebuild Corinth, naming the shining new metropolis Corinth, the praise of Julius. All of the old temples were restored, even enlarged, while new shops and public buildings were constructed. The Romans rewarded this thriving metropolis with a grand 14,000-seat amphitheater and a combined Agora Forum edifice that was larger and more beautiful than any in Rome. Even new waterways were built to quench the growing city's thirst. The population, which was almost entirely Greek, with a smattering of retired Romans, Phoenicians, and Phrygians, lived in what historians consider them to be the most beautiful, modern, and industrious community in the whole of Greece. Further, there was a very small Jewish presence there, and they had no political or religious authority in what was an overtly pagan place. Roman law made it illegal for them to proselyte. So there is no rational way to attribute rabbis or their oral law into this equation. Therefore, recognizing that the Pauline adversary could be none other than Yahweh and his Torah, the final atrocity becomes circumcision, which Paul sees as a cruel and counterproductive mutilation of the flesh. The symbol of the covenant would become his primary foe. Therefore, set in the midst of this Corinthian lecture, and aware of what Paul has written in Galatians, the most rational interpretation of this train of thought is that Satan is suggesting through Paul that Yahweh is someone only a fool would accept. Then as published.
For you bear with anyone if he enslaves you, if he devours you, if he takes advantage of you, if he exalts himself, if he hits you in the face.
Considering the fact that Paul will soon say that his enemies are Hebrews, Israelites, and descendants of Abraham, who ran afoul of him by promoting the merits of the Torah, this is clearly an attack on Yahweh's witness and witnesses. In his next statement, Shaul is now saying that Yahweh and his Torah are anathema, disgrace, and that they are disparaging and dishonorable. Rather than prescriptions for living, according to the pretend apostle, God's guidance as video weakens mankind, incapacitating people, while causing humanity to be powerless. And the solution to this tragedy is Talmud, to dare to become extremely aphrosine, stupid, irrational and ignorant, thoughtless. If that isn't psychotic and delusional, then Webster needs to redefine its terms.
Relative to this disgrace and shame, I say, in this manner that we have been weakened and have become powerless. But in this, whomsoever might dare be so extreme in foolishness, I say, I also am extremely daring and bold in opposition. 2 Corinthians 11 verse 21.
If you think that the creator of the universe, the architect of life, the author of the Torah, the father of the covenant, and our savior is a disgrace, and that the way he provided for us to approach him is dishonorable and ignominious, disparaging, thus, in addition to being enslaving, exploitive, and controlling, then you may be aphrosine. But better that than Talmud, or if you prefer English, psychotic and delusional. So ladies and gentlemen, we now have Paul's answer to God. Ignore him, disregard his Torah. Don't think. Ignorance is bliss. Faith indeed. You can almost hear him saying, sure, my opposition to God is senseless, and you would have to be an idiot to believe that I'm speaking for God when I am constantly contradicting and demeaning him. But if you don't think about any of this, none of it will bother you. To be bold and senseless, at the same time, is to be patriotic, to be resolutely religious, or to be a political zealot. This mantra reflects Machiavelli's approach to power, where the ends justifies the means, where truth is irrelevant, and where daring in the extreme becomes the ultimate weapon. The Nestle Allen's NCREYNOLDS interlinear renders Paul's words in this fashion.
By dishonor I say is that we have weakened. In lit book and slash say, some might dare in thoughtlessness I say dare also I.
Also dealing with 2 Corinthians 11 verse 21, the New American Standard Bible ignored logo, I say, toward the beginning of this rather ignorant and irrational statement, and added my, must, by comparison, and else, as well as the parenthetical, without textual support.
To my shame I must say that we have been weak by comparison, but in whatever respect anyone else is bold, I speak in foolishness, I am just as bold myself.
Noticing the parenthetical, I am compelled to tell you that the NASB added,
I speak as if insane.
In the midst of Paul's comments in the 23rd verse of 2 Corinthians 11, and should you wonder, it is in the 22nd and 24th verses that Paul lists his adversaries who, as I've mentioned, are not so coincidentally Satan's foes, Hebrews, Yisraelites, the descendants of Abraham, and Yahudim, Jews. Not only have Yahweh's chosen people been ensconced as Paul's enemies, there is something very troubling about Paul's continued focus on himself, his delusions and paranoia, rather than Yahusha. Before we move on, note that as Benio, we have become incapacitated and diseased, infirmed and feeble, weakened and powerless through corruption and perversion, is the verbal form of asthenia, something Paul will revel in and boast about. Here he is attributing the incapacitation born of corruption to God and his Torah. But soon he will ascribe this condition to himself, to Satan, and to the graces. It is one of the most astonishing and awkward juxtapositions ever recorded. So now that Shaul has openly acknowledged that he is more daring in his pursuit of stupidity than anyone, and that he is in bold opposition to evidence and reason, let's examine his list of those whom we must assume are his foes, and thus irrational representatives of the truth.
Are they Hebrews, as am I? Are they Israelites, as am I? Are they the seed of Abraham, as am I? 2 Corinthians 11 verse 22.
As is the case with most duplicitous individuals, Shaul wants to claim every scrap of legitimacy for himself, even when trying to undermine the very same sources he is claiming affiliation. It is as if he wants the reader to believe that since he is a Hebrew Israelite, that it is somehow appropriate for him to discredit them. I suppose it is like some African Americans believing that it is excusable for them to refer to their race using the N-word, while it would be considered hateful for someone outside their community to say it. In this light, it is telling that Shaul not only changed his Hebrew name to Paulus, which is of Latin origin, but also has chosen to disregard the name Yahweh gave to Abram after he responded to the terms of the covenant. Abraham, merciful and enriching father. It speaks volumes about Shaul's disrespect for all things Yahweh and his covenant. There is another aspect of this statement which is indeed troubling to those who are informed and rational. In Galatians, Paul's first letter, he initiates his assault against the Torah by stating in 3 verse 16 that the seed of Abraham was singular, and that it thereby referred exclusively to Christos, thereby excluding all other descendants of Abraham, and thus the Hebrews and Israelites, and by implication, the Torah. But now, he has expressly stated that he, himself, is the seed of Abram. This either means that Paul is presenting himself as the Christos, and thus as the Christian Messiah, or that he is an irrational hypocrite because by doing this he just undermined his premise for discarding the Torah. This next are they, should have been catalogued with the previous three. It is designed to undermine Hebrews, Israelites, and the offspring of Abraham, disassociating them from Yahusha, so that their testimony can be disregarded.
Are they servants running errands for Christ too? 2 Corinthians 11 verse 23.
And here is the payoff line, proving that our diagnosis of Paul is valid. This man who became both psychotic and delusional wrote,
Having become insane, I speak for the sake of, about, and beyond I in exceedingly great works and extraordinary burdens in overwhelming imprisonment by an abundance of cards, in extremely severe beatings and blows, in death many times. 2 Corinthians 11 verse 23.
The man, who will admit to being demon-possessed 13 sentences hence in this very letter, has now admitted to being insane, to being completely out of his mind. And to prove it, he is now hallucinating. Paul has lost all touch with reality. He has become the very definition of psychotic. So how is it that the ravings of this madman have become the basis of the world's most popular religion? How is it that billions believe him, even when he contradicts and demeans God? Why would anyone in their right mind consider this rubbish to be scripture? While Paulus will soon blame Satan for all of his foibles, including being beaten and guarded, at this point in his narrative, he would like us to believe that it was all the fault of those dastardly Jews. Satan's enemy had become Paul's foe. They had made him crazy and then they had excessively burdened him, constantly imprisoning him, savagely beating him, only to kill him over and over again. Well, that is if you're prone to believe Paul. However, if you prefer sanity, Yahudim, Jews, did not have the authority nor the inclination to do any of these things in Corinth, Thessalonica, Galatia, Rome, Damascus, Tarsus, or any of the other places Paulus traveled, proving once again that the founder of the Christian religion was now delusional. And if you would prefer simple logic over history, anyone who claims to have been killed often, as in many times, might not be entirely sane. While I've had more than my share of near-death experiences, having nearly lost my life 7 times, boasting about them would never occur to me. I'd much rather share the joy associated with living in Yah's covenant. And while I've taken more than my fair share of lumps for opposing Muhammad and Paul, the abuse I've endured pales in comparison to the satisfaction associated with sharing Yah's word. I've never once been anxious, not even during any of the many thousands of radio interviews. I've never wanted for anything that God did not provide. I've never felt alone. I have always recognized that I've gained vastly more than I've given. So based upon my personal experience, as someone devoted to conveying Yahweh's message, it's obvious to me that there is something dreadfully wrong with Paul. Continuing to hallucinate, the delirious and deranged wannabe apostle wrote,
by Yahudim 5 times, 40 besides 1, I received. 2 C 11 verse 24, 3 times I was beaten with sticks, once I was stoned, 3 times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day, I was caused to drown in the depths. 2 C 11 verse 25, many times in perilous journeys, in dangerous rivers, in threats from bandits, from perilous kin, from dangerous races, in a threatening city, in perilous solitude, in a dangerous body of water, by pseudo-brothers, 2 C 11 verse 26, in bothersome and difficult work and in toilsome hardship, in constant sleeplessness, in prolonged, severe hunger and thirst, in frequently going without food, in cold and nakedness, 2 C 11 verse 27, independently and by myself, besides the addition of the constant stopping to quell rebellions of the extent of my daily anxiety and distracting care of all of the called out assemblies. 2 Corinthians 11 verse 28.
Yes, not only was Paulus killed multiple times, evidently facilitating his own personal resurrections, he was the first to cruise in a submarine, having spent 24 hours at the bottom of the sea. In that the maximum depth of the Aegean Sea is 11,624 feet just east of Crete, it's easy to see why he put this remarkable feat on his resume. Every reference to that which was perilous, dangerous, and threatening came from Kindinos. It was repeated after journeys, rivers, bandits, kin, races, a city, solitude or perhaps a desert, and a body of water, which I suppose was a late because he'd already mentioned his misfortune on the high seas. So maybe it's just me, but if in addition to all of this, I had been overburdened, severely beaten, and killed multiple times, and had received 39 lashes 5 times, had been attacked by sticks and stones, even shipwrecked, I might look for a better god. I realize that Yahweh isn't a micromanager, but he protected the children of Israel when they were in the wilderness with him. He fed them, quenched their thirst, and tended to their clothing. He bore their burdens, doing all of the heavy lifting himself. He even quelled their rebellions. So it is obvious that the God of Israel and Paulus's God are remarkably different. Pathetic as ever, the naked, emaciated, and mutilated apostle of an absentee God was annoyed because he had to epistasis, constantly stop what he was doing to quell rebellions, to halt upheavals, and to suppress attacks from riotous mobs which became a disturbing hindrance. So the world's most infamous punching bag must have simultaneously been a one-man army. And all the while there was anxiety over the distracting care of all of those assemblies. Quite simply, in his own mind, he was the most important and interesting man in the world. He was also demon-possessed and insane, but who of us is perfect? Rather than explaining Yahusha's journey through Passover and unleavened bread, and his suffering on these days to enable the Torah's promises to facilitate our salvation, Paul was fixated on delineating his personal afflictions, both real and imagined, even though they are absolutely of no value to anyone, nor do they have any bearing on anyone's salvation. Moreover, based upon the fact that Paul described three different variations of what happened to him on the road to Damascus, that his accounting of his time thereafter as well as his depiction of the Jerusalem summit were all contradictory and inaccurate, the likelihood that Paul endured any of these things is remote. And yet it is hard to miss the intent. It appears as if Satan was auditioning Paul for the role of his Messiah. Problems abound in his last statement. First among them, by using parakdos, in addition, and chorus, separately and estranged, in succession, we are compelled to render choruses without any help, as in independently, apart from any relationship, as opposed to translating it besides. In other words, Paul isn't saying in addition besides, but instead, in addition to being beaten up, and going to bed hungry and cold, I alone have borne a burden of suppressing riots and caring for all of the assemblies. So now, even the pretense of representing the real Messiah is gone. It is Paul against the world in addition to being against God. It isn't often that we are afforded a window into a deranged and psychotic mind, but Paul, in addition to being insane, was a megalomaniac, so he was ever ready to share his afflictions and affinities. And now he seems to be telling us that when he is empowered, Yahweh and his Torah are weakened, becoming incapacitated and impotent. And that so long as he isn't shot down in flames, God's credibility is questioned, with his Torah becoming unbelievable as a result of having been slandered and scandalized.
Who is weak and incapacitated when I am not incapacitated nor weak? Who stumbles, ceasing to be credible when I am not myself destroyed in the fire? 2 Cor 11:29. So since it is necessary to brag of my limitation and weakness, I will boast. 2 Cor 11:30.
Commenting upon 2 Cor 11:21, I alerted you to the fact that Paul would transition from attributing the process of aspenia, and thus the concept of aspenia, from God to himself. That is beginning here. Paul is saying that the negative aspects of aspenia befall God when they are not attributed to him. Therefore, it is germane for you to realize that aspenia depict perversions which have made us ill, inadequacies and infirmities caused by our corruptions, sicknesses born of our dishonesty, weakness which results from our tendency to defile, to profane, and to dishonor that which is set apart, and incapacitation, weakness, and lack of insights derived from our willingness to pollute and sully the established conditions. And while I will prove the validity of this amplified definition, especially in the context of the work of the Messiah, when we consider 2 Cor 12:9 in concert with Satan's influence on Shaul's life, and with the effect of the graces, For now, just pause long enough to consider the implications of what this man just wrote in this light. The implication is that Paul is suggesting that even bridled by Satan, even beaten and bruised by Jews, even starved and naked, even distracted by riotous mobs, even fighting off pesky thieves, even fording perilous rivers and dangerous waters, oh my, that he is still able to thwart God by perverting his testimony. And if these afflictions are not what he is bragging about overcoming to incapacitate the most trustworthy and noteworthy foe, then what and who is he boasting about? The notion of glorifying oneself in association with God makes me nauseous. When individuals mistakenly credit something I've written with being somehow responsible for them coming to know Yah, I cringe. All I'm doing is conveying his message. It is his testimony, not mine, and he's doing all of the work. I'm just along for the ride. So at most, I'm nothing more than a flawed implement, and I know it. So to brag about besting God is beyond my comprehension. It is beyond my capacity to understand why anyone would knowingly and purposefully try to slander and undermine the most brilliant, powerful, wonderful, loving, and generous individual in the universe. I love my dad, and I'm grateful for everything he has done for me, especially since I'm so undeserving. This is therefore hard for me to deal with. It is insane. And speaking of psychosis, after what we have just read, Paul's next statement borders on schizophrenic.
The God and Father of the Lord Jesus has known the one being praised and worthy of commendation throughout the universe and forever because I absolutely cannot lie, 2 Corinthians 11 verse 31.
While God is our Father, Yahusha, as the diminished corporeal manifestation of Yahweh is the antithesis of the Lord. The Lord is Satan's title because it describes his ambition. That mistake acknowledged, in the midst of this braggadocious diatribe, and with Shaul presenting himself as the source of universal and everlasting truth, the most rational conclusion is that Paulus is presenting himself as commendable and praiseworthy, the source of healing words and beneficial speech. As further affirmation, he has already told us that God knew him and chose him before he was born. As such, this may be Shaul's most presumptions, egotistical, and delusional statement thus far. However, there may be a glimmer of truth in these words, especially when we recognize that Shaul's Lord is auditioning for the role of God through Paulus. Satan wants to father a different covenant by way of his New Testament, thereby causing the existing one to be considered obsolete. And as the means to this madness, the adversary needs to recast Yahusha as his ally and Yahweh's adversary. So what the devil could not achieve by tempting Yahusha in the wilderness, he would accomplish by having Paul claim that he was the lone authorized apostle for Esau. This enabled him to change his identity, to corrupt his testimony, and to counterfeit every aspect of his life. By claiming to be the chosen one, the one whose words were praiseworthy and commendable, the one whose message was universal and eternal, and as the one who could never lie, for the gullible, it was mission accomplished. All Shaul and his Lord had to do now was play the cards from the hand they had dealt to themselves. As for Yahusha, he never seeks commendation or praise. His every inclination was to direct our reverence and esteem toward where it is deserved, which is toward the Father, not the Son. So there is no rational way to see this as anything other than Paul not only claiming that his every word was eternally true, even beneficial, but also that he could never deceive nor mislead. Once those lies are ingested, believers begin to see his testimony as scripture. Then it is mission accomplished. The devil is worshipped as if he were God. While every aspect of this premise is delusional, especially since Paul is an egregious liar and also insane, once the poison is ingested, the antidote, which is the Torah, is discarded. And with the remedy removed, the venom paralyzes each victim. For example, this very statement is irrational. In the midst of discrediting and invalidating God's previous testimony, Paulus is claiming that this same and reliable source can be trusted to provide him with this stellar endorsement. Equally absurd, God, whose testimony is to be forgotten, is being presented as knowing and remembering, while the newly minted source of universal and everlasting truth is unaware and forgetful. Only an insane man would say that he cannot lie. It is yet another telling sign of his insecurity. Those who suffer from this infirmity habitually deceive, all while claiming that they are truth-tellers. Paul is a classic case, and few things he said were more incriminating than what he had previously stated to this same audience.
And I became to the Jews like Jews in order that I might make a profit by procuring an advantage over Jews, to those under Torah, in such a way to show a weak relationship under Torah, not being himself under Torah, for the purpose that those under Torah I might make a profit by procuring an advantage over, 1 C 9 verse 20, to those Torahless and thus without the Torah, in such a way to show a weak relationship with Torahless, not being Torahless of God, to the contrary and making a contrast, in the Torah of Christ do in order that I might make a profit by procuring an advantage and winning over those without the Torah, 1 C 9 verse 21, I came to exist to the unable and morally weak, incapacitated and inadequate, in order that those impotent and sick I might make a profit by procuring an advantage over, to everyone I have become every kind of thing in order that surely by all means some I might save. 1 Corinthians 9 verses 20 to 22.
I would be remiss if I did not tell you that when Paul admitted to being weak and sick, he used asthenes, the adjective variation of the verb aspenio and the noun aspenia. Therefore, he was admitting to being weak as a result of his corruptions and sick due to his perversions. But we don't have to turn back the clock to find a deliberate lie. What follows is not only inaccurate, it is both irrelevant and incongruous.
In Damascus, the official appointed by King Artaxerxes was posting guards against the city of Damascus to capture and arrest me, 2 C 11 verse 32, but through a small opening in a wall in a woven basket, I was let down through a city wall and I fled, escaping the hands of him, 2 Corinthians 11 verse 33.
In Galatians 1 verse 18, Paul wrote that 3 years transpired prior to his initial visit to Jerusalem. He said that he traveled throughout Syria and Cilicia thereafter in 1 verse 21. Then in Galatians 2 verse 1, Paul stated that another 14 years passed before he, Barnabas, and Titus went back to Jerusalem for the summit with the disciples Yohanan, Shimon, and Jacob. That meeting took place in 50 CE. King Aretas was assigned administration of Damascus no earlier than 37 CE. You do the math and subtract 18 years from 50 CE and see if it doesn't place the basket rescue in 32 CE, a year before Yahusha's fulfillment of the first four microi, and at least 5 years before a Damascus official could have been appointed by Aretas. Moreover, there would be no reason that Shaul would be sought out for arrest by anyone, much less by a Nabatean king, within days of his encounter with lightning bolt. Further discrediting Shaul's testimony, in Acts 9 verses 23 to 26, we were told that Jews plotted together to do away with him, and that their plot became known to Shaul. These same Jews were watching the gates day and night so that they might put him to death, which is why his disciples took him by night and led him down through the wall, lowering him in a basket. But now the foe is King Aretas, a Nabatean, and therefore not Jews. Even more incriminating, Aretas would never have deployed Jewish guards. His daughter had married Herod Antipas, but when Herod divorced Phasaelis to take his brother's wife, Aretas, to avenge his daughter's honor, invaded Yahuda and defeated Herod, capturing the west bank of the Jordan River. When Herod complained to Emperor Tiberius, he dispatched the governor of Syria to attack Aretas, an action which wasn't actually carried out because of the emperor's death in 37 CE. So, suffice it to say, there is no chance that Aretas had control over Syria, and thus Damascus, prior to 37 CE, and at the time, the last people he would have assisted would have been Jews. Therefore, by reviewing Aretas's history, Paul's evolving and conflicting stories are exposed as complete fabrications. This means that Paul was not only a false prophet, he was unable to keep his own history straight. So much for the myth that he wasn't able to lie.
End of part 3.